The Leia Marathon Show. Sponsored by Step Finance, your go-to DeFi portfolio manager on Solana. BitMEX, the OG crypto derivatives platform and the best place to buy your Bitcoin.
Things really are just starting to heat up.
Hey guys, and welcome back to the Leia Heilpern Show. So today is going to be a really exciting show. We're trying to understand what is going on with the markets and what we can expect from Bitcoin throughout the rest of 2022. So I have an amazing guest to delve into all of this. But before we dive in, this particular month is sponsored by the cryptocurrency exchange BitMEX. So a huge shout out to BitMEX, because without them, we wouldn't be able to bring you such valuable content. As of May the 17th, they're actually launching a brand new spot exchange to easily and instantly buy and sell your crypto. So to celebrate, they're giving away $1 million in crypto to spot traders over the next few months. And this is actually one of the biggest giveaways in crypto right now. So if you are eager to enter, then I'm going to leave the some information with a link for you in the description. So it's going to be really exciting. There's a huge range of different assets that you can actually trade on there. So the information is all in the description. And a huge thank you to BitMEX, because without them, like I said, we wouldn't be able to bring you such exciting content. So let's get into this. Joining me today is Lynn Alden from Lynn Alden Investment Strategy to help us try and make some sense of the markets. Lynn, how are you?
Good. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's really great to have you. I've been following your content for a while, and you seem to be getting this spot on. You were early with Terra, predicting what was going to happen. So I'm really excited to get your perspective on the markets right now. But before we get into all of this, you have a strong background in aviation. So I'm really interested to understand how you went from the aviation industry into finance. Where did that come into things?
Yeah, it's a good question. My background is electrical engineering, and specifically I worked in the aviation industry. So I started out as an engineer, and then I worked my way up into engineering management and running the finances of that facility. And going back prior to that, I had, you know, I had a long-term kind of interest in finance and investing, as well as science and math and technology. And so I kind of pursued the engineering field as my initial profession while investing on the side. And then at some point I decided to switch out of that and focus on investing in, public research, public writing full-time.
And you do the traditional side of things. You know, you talk about markets like securities, commodities, and then you also get involved in crypto, digital assets. So this is really interesting, because they're obviously very different. So do you think that digital assets like Bitcoin are the future, or in 10 to 15 years, do you think that you're going to continue to stay diversified with traditional markets?
Well, I mean, I think they basically are a new platform for things that already exist. So in many ways, for example, Bitcoin is a commodity, right? It's classified for most tax purposes like a commodity. You know, it doesn't pass the Howey test, so it's not a security, it's not an equity. So the best analogy we have for it is a digital commodity. And then you have things like stable coins that are digital fiat. They're just digitally native fiat, basically a new medium for fiat currencies. And then you have a variety of other platforms that in many ways look like equities, right? For example, they have a network, they have a platform, and then they invite people to use their platform in various ways. And then people can judge what is the total addressable market of that platform? What does the long-term outlook of that platform look like? And so, you know, I think that basically this is being integrated into, you know, markets as they currently are, and we'll see what kind of technologies come out of this.
So in about 10 to 15 years, you don't think they're going to be considered alternative markets? It's just going to be part and parcel of how people trade, essentially. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I think Bitcoin will be here to stay probably in 10 to 15 years. I think that has a long runway of growth ahead of it before, you know, unless it runs into some sort of tail risk. So that's number one. I do think that stable coins, basically that money is going to flow over blockchain rails more. So I'm bullish on the proliferation of stable coins, for example. I think that's a better medium than we'd be using in the past. And then, you know, we'll find out what the total addressable market is for distributed compute, basically, you know, smart contracts, federated networks. You know, we'll see if they can be used to bring down settlement times, things like that. That's still a very highly competitive industry. And a lot of that's been kind of based on, I think, artificial incentives. And so when the dust settles, we'll see, you know, what is the actual kind of underlying utility for some of those technologies.
Yeah, absolutely. Things are still playing out. As they always say, we are still early. So it's going to take some time to sort of see what's going to be there in the next 10 to 15 years. But what we know is not necessarily going to be there is something which you predicted this week. So I've never seen anything quite like this with Luna tanking to zero. You predicted exactly this, I think it's about 2 weeks ago on the 1st of May. You said if the Luna price declines, UST would lose its peg and the LFG would have to sell its Bitcoin to stabilize UST. So how did you come to this analysis? Do you have to have some kind of engineering finance background like you to be able to have this depth of knowledge? How did you land there?
So that was mostly from analyzing it as though I would analyze an emerging market. And they were kind of using similar overall economics. And so, for example, if you look at an emerging market central bank, they issue liabilities, which is their emerging market currency. And then they hold other assets, such as treasuries or gold, that they can use to defend that. If they start to run low on those reserves, you have to really get concerned about that currency. And so what essentially an algorithmic stablecoin is, it's kind of like an emerging market central bank that runs on autopilot. They're not really prone to stability. They kind of always have these inherent weaknesses. And, Terra tried to shore up their weaknesses by buying Bitcoin in a similar way that emerging market would buy gold. But my concern was that, in a risk-off environment, which is what we're in now, most of the crypto space tends to suffer. And when that happens to Luna's total equity value compared to their UST value, that can eventually erode the value of their equity and result in a death spiral, which is what we saw.
So you predicted this perfectly well. My question is, why were we able to get into the situation where people have lost their life savings? I don't understand how people weren't able to, speak loud enough about this. Those running, Doc Guan, why wasn't he able to spot the weaknesses here? How did this happen?
I think there are two things. Number one is that it's hard, so I kind of outlined what would happen. The question was, I didn't know when it was going to happen, right? So I didn't know if it was going to happen in May. I didn't know if it was going to happen in June. I didn't know if they'd be able to salvage this, get more capital injection ahead of time and push it back another year, right? So it's hard to say when it's going to fail. So that's number one. Number two is, I think a lot of people in the space, they have a low incentive to be critical and a high incentive to kind of promote things. And especially with an algorithmic stablecoin, it's really based on confidence. And so it's always confidence, confidence, confidence. And I just think not enough people were critical. Now, there were plenty of people besides me, and even some of those helped inform the research I did, right? I didn't just come up out of nowhere. I researched different things that people were saying. I did my own analysis. And so there were plenty of people out there. I just think that, too few people listened to them. Too many people were wrapped up in the gains they were having.
Yeah, a lot of hopium, as they say. They sold, I think it was confirmed today or yesterday, I don't remember. They sold around 80,000 Bitcoin. What's the problem with using Bitcoin as collateral for other blockchain networks? Because I know a lot of people think that that's some of the reasons why the market's tanking, although Bitcoin seems to be stabilizing at around $30,000. What are the issues with using Bitcoin as collateral for other networks?
So I think it's not necessarily using Bitcoin as collateral that's the problem. I mean, in some ways it's ideal collateral. It's still, because it's a young asset, it's still volatile though. So it's less, it's more volatile than treasuries or gold or something like that. So you have to put up with volatile collateral, which is not ideal. But I think the bigger issue is that just by adding Bitcoin to something doesn't fix that thing. If that thing is inherently unstable, it doesn't matter if you have Bitcoin reserves because your thing is unstable. Right. And so, maybe if they had more, they could have prolonged it. They could have had this whole death spiral be a lot slower than it was. It would have been less spectacular. But basically, you can't fix a broken system by adding Bitcoin to it. If a company wants to add Bitcoin to their reserves as a percentage of their long term holdings, I think that can make sense. But if you're inherently an unstable protocol, Bitcoin doesn't fix that.
I'm interested, given the amount of research and your understanding on this digital asset space, what would you say you're most bullish on, which would withstand the test of time then?
So the two areas that I'm bullish on in the crypto space are Bitcoin and stablecoins. Really with Bitcoin, what we're seeing is the test of this new asset. We're seeing how hard it is. We're seeing if it can withstand community disagreements, soft forks, all the different challenges there. So far, it's been able to withstand that. And so I think that's a long-term thing that's going to withstand the test of time, most likely. And then the other one would be that there is a strong global demand for money, for low volatility money, which is stable coins, basically. And the way fiat currency works is that they try to control volatility by devaluing gradually over time, right? So a dollar loses value year after year after year, but in most circumstances, it doesn't explosively lose value over, say, a two-month period. And there's, you know, there's people around the world where, you know, they're living in double-digit inflation. They have restrictive monetary regimes. And, you know, for example, in Argentina or Lebanon, if you had dollars in the bank, let's say you made the decision, you don't want to hold the local currency, you want to hold dollars, they just took the dollars. They can just take them and convert them to local currency, and then you get devalued anyway. And so ironically for them, for people, you know, they'd rather trust, you know, a foreign custodian that could hold dollars to them on the blockchain and take any sort of risks that might come with, you know, the quality of their collateral, things like that, versus storing dollars in their own banking system. And so I think the combination of Bitcoin long-term and stablecoins kind of, you know, intermediate term, I think both those things are real use cases above and beyond speculation that I think are going to persist for quite a while in this industry.
People keep looking at Bitcoin as this, like you said, you know, something which is, it's new, but it's sort of withstanding the test of time. It's a hedge against whatever's happening. But inflation has just hit a 40-year high. The Fed is, you know, increasing interest rates to try to tackle this. So do you think that Bitcoin is going to be able to withstand this supposed recession which is coming?
So I think it will withstand that, but there is significant price risk over the next 12 months. And so if you look back historically, you know, we can even put the question of recession aside and just look at economic acceleration or deceleration, because not all decelerations result in outright recession. And so over the past decade, for example, you can measure it in the Purchasing Managers Index, which is basically a measure of economic activity. And it looks kind of like a sine wave that goes up and down every 3 years. And some of those downturns result in recessions, and other ones result in, say, near recessions. They almost cause a recession, but there's some sort of monetary policy pivot or fiscal stimulus that kind of reflates it from there. And so historically, Bitcoin has generally done very good in rising PMI environments. So economic acceleration, liquidity is flowing. Most risk assets do well, and something with a lot of volatility, like Bitcoin, generally does even better. Then, of course, many of the altcoins, you know, they skyrocket. And then when you have the declining PMI environment, altcoins get killed, Bitcoin suffers, stocks in general, especially riskier ones, overvalued ones tend to suffer, whereas things like cash, defensive value stocks, gold, those sort of assets generally hold up better. And right now, we're kind of firmly in the middle of a declining PMI environment. Now, that doesn't mean that Bitcoin can't, you know, like in the prior declining PMI environment, it managed to bottom before PMI bottomed. It doesn't just follow this perfectly. So I think we've already seen quite a lot of the washout. Whether or not we get a lower low, I still think is anyone's guess. What makes this one so challenging is that because inflation's high, the Fed is trying their best to tighten monetary policy into a weakening environment. They're purposely trying to reduce demand and basically cause a near recession. And I think that's not going to go well for them. I think they're going to have to reverse at some point. But until you get that reversal, I think we are in rather risky territory. So especially if I was trading any sort of leverage, I'd be super careful. And then even unlevered, people just have to make sure that they have the right amount of exposure for whatever volatility they can afford. So I would never recommend that someone put 100% of their portfolio in Bitcoin and things like that. I just think, you know, whatever allocation you want to it based on your education on the asset, your conviction, what you think it's going to be worth in 5-10 years, you can have that allocation. And I think you have to be willing to withstand a lot of price turbulence over the next 12 months, or at least until we see some sort of reversal from these current conditions, which is economic deceleration combined with monetary tightening, which is, you know, pretty much anything other than cash and defensive value things are going to have a rough time there.
They say that Bitcoin is this uncorrelated asset. I mean, it's obviously not given everything you've just said, but do you think we'll get to a point where it's going to be uncorrelated and we're not going to have to deal with everything that you mentioned?
So historically, it's been moderately uncorrelated compared to stocks. It's still generally risk on liquidity play. And in the past 2 years, the correlation went up quite a bit. I think there's a couple of reasons for that. One is that the macro situation was a bigger common variable between assets. So we had the biggest ever injection of liquidity combined with the biggest ever removal of liquidity. And so the vast majority of assets went up and down together, and only kind of specific things like energy start kind of breaking out of that correlation. And so the other factor would be that Bitcoin got big enough that it's now like an institutional asset. And so you have hedge funds trading it. You have a lot of professional money trading it. And so the Venn diagram of who owns Bitcoin versus who owns the NASDAQ came together quite a bit. There's environments where I think that could decouple. One would be if you see a reversal of Fed tightening, so you have more liquidity in the market, but say you still have that combined with inflationary pressures on company margins. That could be an environment where stocks, you know, they might not do that well, whereas, you know, commodities, including gold and Bitcoin, could do pretty well because they're benefiting from liquidity without having to worry about margin pressure. They don't have employees. They don't have margins. They're just, you know, these scarce assets. So that could certainly result in a decoupling. Another one would be that, you know, even though the two types of holders have kind of come together, they're still not completely the same. It's not like the same people all own Bitcoin and NASDAQ. And so, for example, a lot of people are dollar cost averaging in a Bitcoin and they're not buying the NASDAQ. And eventually you can dry up all of the liquidity, basically exhaust all the sellers, and then get a reversal. I think that's you're most likely to see that when you have more liquidity in the market and when you have a rising PMI environment.
So just going back a sec to this looming recession, which is supposedly coming, what does this mean for the everyday person? People are always looking for the best way to hedge themselves against this recession, against inflation. And we've kind of been looking at Bitcoin as sort of this answer. Don't worry about the stock market, just pick Bitcoin. Don't worry about property, just pick Bitcoin. So where does the average person go from here when they know that this recession is coming?
So to take a step back, I think we can describe it. We're in an economic decelerating environment that might or may not go into a full recession. I think on the current track, we are likely headed towards one, but I would just, you know, caution against saying, you know, a recession is sure. I think what we can say for sure in the data currently is that we're in a decelerating economic environment. So that's number one. Number two, you know, if we talk about the average person, that can vary tremendously based on what country you're in. Right. I mean, someone in Turkey has a different currency situation to deal with than someone in Canada, for example. Right. And so right now, the dollar is at the heart of the global financial system. So when the Fed's tightening, you know, basically the reason why when the economy goes down and the Fed tightens, the reason why dollars, you know, pretty much go up compared to almost everything else is because that's the unit that debt is denominated in. And you're basically tightening everyone's debts relative to their assets. And so everything that's basically denominated in dollars, you know, struggles. And so in that type of environment, if you're in the United States or other developed countries, holding a larger than normal cash position can help you get through that kind of turbulence. And then you can deploy it when you see some sort of pivot. You can get into whatever risk asset you prefer. Whereas if you're in a periphery market, if you're in a market that's suffering currency problems, whether it's Argentina or Turkey and things like that, you know, those hard assets are still working better for you than owning your local currency. Doesn't mean every single week or every single month, but if you look at a long-term chart of, say, Bitcoin priced in Turkish lira, you know, there's no doubt that it's a good inflation hedge. Same thing for gold, or same thing if you hold dollar stable coins, things like that. So I think the way that people can interact with this depends on where they are in the world, what their liabilities are denominated in, and what they're kind of experiencing in their local markets. So I think that basically the general trend is that when you have this kind of risk off, you know, Fed tightening, economic decelerating environment, you generally want to be more defensive. And that can mean different things for different people in the world. And then when you have that kind of rising PMI, Fed loosening type of environment, that's when you can consider taking on more risk. And, you know, another way to phrase this is that right now we have a lot of scarcity in things that we want, especially energy. Energy is scarce. And then because that's the master resource, that affects food scarcity and all these other things. And the Fed can't print more oil. They can't print more ships and ports. They can't print more wheat. All they can try to do is try to reduce the demand for those things. That's the way that they can try to deal with inflation. But reducing demand is basically synonymous with a recession. That's what a recession is, basically a reduction in economic activity. And so in their minds, they're trying to do just a small one. Right. You know, just trying to take the edge off demand without causing an outright recession. Historically, the odds of doing that are very low. Right. So it's like being a little bit pregnant. Right. The Fed has a bad track record of being a little bit pregnant. It's either they fuel recession or they don't. and you know, at least more often than not. And so they're kind of on the track now. They're trying to curtail demand. And so that, you know, that challenges people in different ways. Inflation is a challenge for people. And then also when the Fed is purposely trying to reduce demand, that's also challenging for people. So I think right now it's kind of, you want to buckle down, you want to make sure you have access to the supplies you need, and you want to be defensive, whatever that means for your personal situation.
Why do you think we've gotten into this sort of mess? I mean, I know we've seen endless amounts of money printing over the last 2 years. We have, anonymous accounts on Twitter been tweeting, don't print money, that's bad. Like, how can these, anonymous accounts on Twitter with probably no financial background say, don't print money, that's bad. And then the Fed prints money and we end up in this situation. So is this done on purpose? Is this out of lack of intelligence? I don't know. Why are we in such dire straits?
I think the seeds of this go back decades. I think that's the hard part. It's kind of like this big ship. There's no single person responsible for it. It's the accumulation of moderately bad decisions over decades until it becomes a severely bad situation. And so basically, every time we have a downturn, right? So decades ago, if you have a downturn, you could just let it play out. Let the bad leverage go away. Let it play out. They chose not to do that. They chose to inflate the next bubble and basically, convince people to take on even more debt. And the problem is you eventually blow such a big bubble that you can never retract it. It would crash even the government bond market if it were to contract. And so their pretty much only way out there is to inflate it away. They have to hold interest below the inflation rate, and you can't kind of deleverage enough debt nominally. So you have to basically increase the denominator, which is currency units, until you quote unquote fix the problem. And of course, that's a very uncomfortable situation for most market participants. And I think that's the stage of the cycle we're in, although there can be kind of, intermediate term pushbacks, right? So right now where they don't want to admit that's what they're doing. So they're like, hey, we're going to tighten, we're going to tighten policy. And I think what's going to happen is the economy is going to weaken enough that they're going to have to stop tightening. And then, inflation is still high and they have to pivot, and then they're kind of out of excuses. So I think that the problem now is the accumulation of moderately bad decisions. And then you have other things layered on top of that, like the commodity cycle, right? There's periods where, commodity prices are high. Everybody comes in and they drill new wells, they find new copper deposits, they put all that CapEx in until they have too much supply. And then you get a decade long bad prices. No new capital wants to come in until you burn off all that excess supply. And that's kind of what we're in now. We just had a more than a 10-year period of reducing commodity prices, outright deflationary commodity prices in most cases. And that era, I think, is behind us. I think we've already used up a lot of the excess supply that we've had. And now we're kind of entering this another period of scarcity where, until we get a lot of new commodity and infrastructure supply online, we're going to have problems in terms of having disinflationary growth. So we're either going to have economic contractions or we're going to have very inflationary types of growth because it's the combination of the currency being a problem and underinvestment in hard assets.
And you mentioned that depending on which country you're in, your situation is unique to you, that you have different liabilities, which is interesting because today it was announced that I think it was 44 heads of states are heading to El Salvador to discuss Bitcoin. El Salvador seems to be clearly very much underwater with their Bitcoin investment. So I want to get your take on how smart you think that their move is.
So I think their decision to include Bitcoin as legal tender smart. I think they've gotten a lot of tourism and investment out of it. The problem is that those types of decisions don't come freely, right? And so the biggest risk for them is that foreign creditors don't want to buy their bonds anymore. And so their costs of financing are very, very high. And so I think that's the biggest issue challenging them, right? That basically the current kind of system is built to try to have it so the countries can't leave the system, right? And so if you try to leave the system, you better be prepared to deal with the consequences. And so I think that's what they're going through now. Bitcoin can't just instantly fix a lot of the issues that El Salvador has related to crime, related to all the challenges that historically faced the country. And so when you combine that with, the IMF and other entities kind of pushing back on you, you know, that's a challenge. And so in any sort of declining PMI environment, when the Fed's tightening, basically what they're doing is they're breaking all the countries that have kind of done their own thing. And we'll see which ones can get through it. I still have open questions about how successful El Salvador is going to be in navigating this. And I think that remains to be seen. I think there's very little downside, you know, say outside of what the foreign creditors are going to do, there's very little downside in saying, you know, we accept this other currency as legal tender in addition to the one we already were, right? So they've not made dollars non-legal tender. They still are. And if anything, the data shows, I mean, you know, the vast majority of economic activity is still in dollars. And so, you know, I don't think that the direct implications of using Bitcoin have been a problem for the country. I think it's the international creditor reaction to that decision.
Why do you think they've had such a bad reaction?
Well, partially because they like the status quo. So if a country tries to leave that status quo, that's, you know, that's not good in their eyes. They want to punish them. Another thing I think is that managers of large pools of capital are, you know, they consider this risky. It's outside of the bounds of things that they're familiar with. And they say, you know what, I just don't want to own El Salvador bonds. That's an easy, you know, if I have a portfolio of bonds from 50 developing countries and this one did something that I don't understand, and it's 1% of my portfolio, it's easy for me to be, you know what, I'm just going to take that money out and I'm going to put it into another country that I understand. And so I think the combination of just a lot of creditors have just said, I don't really want to have exposure. And so that comes down, we'll see if they can get alternative financing, and we'll see to what extent that this can pay off in the long term, even though the actual decision of having Bitcoin legal tender has had neutral to positive implications, as far as I can see.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you. I mean, I haven't yet been to El Salvador, but I'm excited to go for tourism reasons. I imagine it's had a huge, it's brought a huge amount of new people in, which is really exciting. So back to the markets just for a second. So given billions of dollars has been wiped off the market very quickly, where do you think we are right now? Rao Powell and Willy Wu, for example, talk about this four-year cycle being over. So it's not really driven by the Bitcoin halving anymore. So I'd be really interested to know your thoughts on that, and sort of where you see us going, from after the next 12 months to maybe 18 months to 2 years.
I think if investors want to focus on one cycle, it would be the U.S. Purchasing Managers Index cycle. So that PMI cycle that I already referenced. And that's roughly a three-year cycle. There's no rule that says it has to be 3 years. It just historically has been about 3 years. That's kind of the cycle of investment decisions and things like that. And so I think if you follow the PMI cycle over time, that can give you a general idea of what's going to happen with risk on versus risk off assets. Now that applies as measured in dollars, right? So if you're in a country that's having a spiraling inflation problem, you could probably ignore that and just focus on, you want to own hard assets. You don't want to own your local currency in large amounts. I'm mostly there referring to investors that would denominate their unit of exchange in dollars. So I would say that we're still in this kind of risk-off environment. It doesn't mean we're necessarily going to get lower lows. I have no idea.
Okay.
It generally means that excess risk-taking is probably not where a lot of capital is going to flow to. And so you want to look for either a rising PMI environment or some sort of Federal Reserve monetary policy pivot. And in that kind of rising liquidity cycle is where I think Bitcoin would have its next bull run, which I think at the current time, you point out to 2023, sometime in that time frame. But again, these cycles, there's no hard focus on them. And Bitcoin is not bottom and top, you know, precisely with the cycle, even though it is closely aligned historically with those cycles.
The interesting thing is every metric on the Bitcoin network is looking pretty healthy right now. The hash rate is at an all-time high. Bitcoin is coming off of exchanges at record highs. I think I read today that the amount of wallets holding one whole Bitcoin has just hit record highs. User adoption is going up quickly. So in your opinion, other than, you know, this inflation and everything that we've spoken about, what do you think is holding the price down?
So certainly one of the factors was what happened with Terra. And that was one of the concerns I wrote about ahead of time, which is that if they have to force sell tens of thousands of Bitcoins into the market, that's in an already weak market, that's not great for price. And so what we saw looking at exchange data, for example, is that, you know, the record, you know, coins were coming off exchanges. Then you had this big injection of coins back onto exchanges most likely associated with the Terra Luna, you know, defense. And then since then, it's come off a little bit. You know, there's some dip buyers that probably bought in and bought some cheap sats, but it's still higher than it was before the Luna event. And so I think that basically there's tens of thousands of coins that have to find a new home. So there's kind of, you know, and then there's people that are shocked by the price. So you have weak hands selling, strong hands buying the dip. And I think you have to have that rotation until you basically exhaust the sellers and the buyers are still happy. And so that's kind of what happens in this risk off type of environment. Another thing is that, you know, not all the coins are moving on chain, right? A lot of it's just happening within exchange ledgers. It's also happening in futures markets. And so basically, there's very few large fast money pools of capital that are like, you know what, I want to buy Bitcoin right now, right? That's not what we're seeing. They're basically saying, I want to be risk off right now until I have better clarity on what's going to happen with liquidity, what's going to happen with the economy. And so because it's that risk off environment, the marginal buyer is not really showing up. There's not a lot of outside capital flowing into the space. And so you have a difference between what, say, the hodlers are doing, right? So they're showing very strong adoption. We've seen a number of people that say we're in the Luna system, and then they say, you know what, I'm a Bitcoin maxi now. You know, so you have some rotation there, but then you also just have large pools of capital that are like, you know, I'm gonna let the dust settle and see what's happening with macro before I put in new capital. So basically, I would say overall demand is relatively weak at the current time, even though there's pockets of obviously very strong demand.
Yeah, you make a funny point. The best way to make a Bitcoin maxi is to have weeks like this. I think there's a lot of Bitcoin maxis that have been converted. But what do you think about Bitcoin versus Bitcoin derivatives? For example, everyone is pushing for the spot ETF, which is good for mass adoption. But is it better to hold the actual Bitcoin or Bitcoin derivatives that can obviously be manipulated?
So there are different pools of capital that have different requirements. So I think if you're in a position where you can, I think it's better to own the underlying Bitcoin. You know, that's kind of the part of the reason the asset is desirable is because you can hold it without counterparty risk, right? You can hold it. You can hold your own wallet. You can have multi-signature solutions. So I think that's ideal when possible. But there's some types of monies that is 401k money. You have it with an advisor. You have it in Fidelity, whatever the case may be. You have it in your brokerage. And maybe you want Bitcoin exposure there. And you don't want to, maybe you don't want to have to worry about, maybe you're fine with counterparty risk. You'd rather trust Fidelity than yourself, right? And I think there are plenty of people that maybe want to be in that position, or they want to split the difference. They want to say, look, I have my own stack, but I also want to have additional exposure that maybe is in my brokerage account. And so I think that there's different types of products for different pools of capital. There's also, you know, say a pension or other, you know, kind of large entity like that insurance company, you know, their charter might, you know, restrict them to buying securities, right? That they might not be able to own the underlying property. And so they want a wrapper around it, someone to manage it on their behalf. And it could be Grayscale. It could be, you know, one of these other types of entities. And so I think we just have to be aware that there are different pools of capital that have different goals with what they're trying to do with it and different appreciation of counterparty risks or even preferring having a counterparty. And so I think you're going to see that show up, you know, across the board. I think the more products that are available, the better. I think there should be a Bitcoin ETF because a lot of people have had to buy inferior products due to a lack of a Bitcoin ETF. And so ironically, it's not investor protection. It's, if anything, it's funneling investors into weaker types of investments. You know, they're either buying something that is not necessarily keeping up with the price of Bitcoin. It might be futures based. It might have its, it might not trade with net asset value. It might be an entity that takes on leverage. Basically, people have been forced into those things if they want Bitcoin in their normal brokerage account. So I think over time, you know, the more products available, the more it can be normalized in terms of having a small slice in your 401k or a small slice in your insurance holdings, things like that.
When do you think we'll see a spot ETF?
You know, so I don't have regulatory clarity on that. I think I would say probably the next couple of years. We already have Bitcoin ETFs. The question is when we have one in the United States, right? And so kind of, I think, a shame that the United States has been behind on this compared to other countries. So I would not be shocked if weeks from now, you know, we have a Bitcoin ETF, like we have an announcement of a Bitcoin ETF, but I also wouldn't be shocked if we're sitting here a year and a half from now and we still don't have one. I think there's basically a small number of people that have to decide that there can be one now And so whatever would convince those people. It seems to be that because we see so much casino-like behavior on the exchanges, that seems to be a factor in terms of not having a Bitcoin ETF, which I don't think that necessarily makes sense, but it might be a piece of leverage that regulators have over the exchanges. So I don't really have a strong conviction on when we'll have a Bitcoin ETF, other than I think in the long run, I think we'll have one.
What's your take on regulation? Janet Yellen obviously was saying how the market needs to be regulated better after everything that happened with Terra. The US obviously doesn't have the spot ETF yet. So it's really, the US is very much behind. So how do you think regulation is going to play out for the US? Do you think that it's going to actually be able to remain at the forefront of innovation when it comes to the digital asset space?
So I think the problem is that they want to, in their view, protect consumers without suppressing innovation. And one of the challenges there is that right now, because the technology's progressed faster than regulators know what to do with, we kind of have two markets, right? So normally, if you have something that passes the Howey test, basically your security, then there's various restrictions you have if you want to sell that to the public. You have to have certain disclosures and things like that. Whereas in the digital asset space, someone can make something that for all accounts is a security, and then they can just sell it to people. Someone from, say, a very libertarian background says that's fine. But the problem there is then you have two different types of markets. So, some people might say everything should be, you should sell whatever you want to the consumer. Other people might say, no, we need restrictions. But few people would argue that there should be basically inconsistent regulations, where if you're in this category, you can't sell to the public, but if you're in this other category, you can sell to the public. And so I think over time, we're going to see more unification between securities laws in traditional assets and securities laws in digital assets. I think basically some more of those tests will be applied to some of those projects. And so, for example, it's already the case that most of them, they can't, raise capital from, the broad, American public, right? Now, we could see more restrictions on what exchanges can sell to the public, right? I mean, a lot of exchanges were funneling investors into, meme coins right at the top of their part of the cycle. It's basically whatever's got momentum, they advertise that, they get a lot of people in, and those people get wrecked. And then we see just a lot of exchanges were selling Luna and then later said that, oh, we knew that project was doomed for failure. Well, why did you sell it to the public then? Or why did, So I think that there's going to be a little bit more tightening around what exchanges can make it easy for the public to access. And okay. I don't think that really affects Bitcoin per se, but I think that affects some of the worst areas of the altcoin space. And then there's other, I think there's more problematic concerns like making it harder to custody your own funds. So I would certainly be against those types of regulations. I think people should have the right to self-custody of their own funds. But I think that's something we're seeing pop up in the European Union. You see it pop up from some lawmakers. We'll see what can actually get made into law.
Well, that's interesting because I saw that within the EU. They were talking about, I think it was, you have to screenshot your wallet address or something like that if you're using a non-custodial wallet before you send it. I don't understand how that could be implemented. So how on earth could you implement regulation around self-custody? I can't understand that.
I think it's going to be a very big challenge. And that's actually, that goes back to what Nakamoto's innovation was. So prior to Bitcoin, if you want to send money long distances, you needed to go through a central intermediary, a bank, basically. So if you wanted to do capital controls or sanctions or restrict where money can flow, the government only had to focus on financial institutions, which is really easy to do. But what this did is it opened up peer-to-peer transactions across the world. And so if you want to enforce those types of laws, you now have to enforce it on the consumer layer, which is orders of magnitude harder to do because, say, in America, you're focusing on 330 million people rather than a few thousand banks. Right. And so I think that is in the long run rather untenable. Now, one of the ways you can do it is draconian restrictions where you say, OK, we can't really enforce it too much. But if we catch you, the penalties are severe. And that's actually what they did when they banned gold. I mean, in the United States, you couldn't own gold. It was illegal to own gold for like four decades from the 1930s up to the beginning of the 1970s. And the penalty was up to 10 years in prison. Now, the number of people that actually were charged with any of that was low. They didn't go door to door and get everyone's gold. It was really just, something that they could not enforce. that instead they enforced through draconian penalties. So we'll see if that's the route that they try to take. But essentially, the whole point of this entire field, the whole innovation here, the foundation for what makes this space interesting, especially Bitcoin and stablecoins, is that they basically unlocked global peer-to-peer payments. And that's kind of a Pandora's box that I think, you know, I think different entities around the world are going to struggle with. And I think it's obviously a bigger problem for more authoritarian types of places. And it's less of a problem for places where you actually want to live and that actually have a functioning, you know, economy.
So that brings you on to my last topic, CBDCs, because I know that you're, like you said, you're bullish on stablecoins. But how do you think CBDCs will be adopted versus stablecoins? Do you think we'll have both, or do you think we'll, or do you think one could essentially replace the other in terms of borderless payments, no volatility, and so on?
I think that depends on the jurisdiction, right? And so a country like China pursued the CBDC route over the stablecoin route. One is that they got a big head start. I mean, they started studying that in like 2014. And after years of research and development, they've introduced their version of the CBDC. They also have very few kind of checks and balances on their government. They're obviously prone to surveillance and control. So that's kind of right up their alley. Whereas if you look at the United States, our officials generally did not research this very early on. And so now they're kind of in catch-up mode. And, you know, in these types of environments, generally public-private partnerships tend to be what's used, right? So the federal government will often use contractors, for example. Instead of making all of our own military equipment, we'll have Lockheed Martin make it. We'll have Boeing make it. And so I think in the United States and some of these other similar types of countries, you're more likely to see stablecoins, regulated stablecoins, be used as essentially that mechanism. And so that regulators are still sorting that out. So I don't have super high conviction on what this is going to look like. But I do think that over time, probably some degree of outside partnerships would be used. So for example, the United States can partner with Circle and say, okay, this is a quote unquote bank quality stablecoin. You can use it for these purposes, whereas this other one is not, right? And so I think that's kind of the route that we're probably going to see in parts of the Western world.
Lynn, it's been so fascinating hearing your perspective on all of this, given the state of the world and the market right now. So I really appreciate you coming on. Do you have any last thoughts about, you know, what's going on right now, people who might be potentially concerned because they're very much underwater with their investments? What are your last thoughts?
I think the final thought is to make sure you understand what you own. Make sure you have an assessment of the long-term utility of what it is that you own, and stick to things you understand. Because I think that it's still, you know, whether or not we've seen the bottom, you know, this is obviously that this was a big crashy moment associated with the Terra collapse. So, you know, whether or not it was the bottom or not, I think things that don't have long-term utility still have more to lose. And then even things that are high quality can be temporarily dragged down by deleveraging in associated assets. And so I think it's a risk off environment, and you want to be careful with your leverage and with your exposures, and to make sure that you own the things that you think have a good 5 to 10 year time horizon ahead of them in terms of where this industry is going.
Where can people follow your work?
So I'm at lynnalden.com, and I'm on Twitter at lynnaldencontact.
Guys, please go follow Lynn. Just amazing value there. Predicted everything that was going to happen with the Terra Luna situation. So that was really fascinating. Lynn, thank you so much for coming on. It's been such a pleasure learning from you.
Thanks for having me.
Guys, thanks so much for tuning in. Don't forget to hit the subscribe button, and we'll see you all next week.
The Leah Heilpan Show.